Okay, good morning everyone. I'm going to be talking about something that's slightly different focus from the other presentations in this session. We're not so much focusing in this presentation on dealing with manure or phosphorus fertilizer on the landscape, but moving a little bit more in the direction of how can we address a potential excess of phosphorus in the first place. So source reduction, how can we improve our whole farm balances, and what options do farmers have to do that? We work in the dairy industry in New York, so our primary focus has been to work with forages grown on the dairy systems, working with mass balances as defined in this slide. We talk about a whole farm mass balance, we mean the difference between imports and exports across the farm boundary, and in this case primarily imports through feed, fertilizer, animals, bedding and manure, and then primarily the exports in the dairy industry through sales of milk, animals leaving the farm, crops that might be sold, and then exports in terms of manure for a portion of the farm systems as well. That difference between imports and exports is called the balance, and we express that two ways. One, on a per land base, per acre tillable land, in this case for nutrient recycling, so an environmental indicator. And the other approach is to divide it by the milk produced on the farm, so per hundredweight, and that is more of a nutrient use efficiency indicator for the whole farm. So keep this in mind. We have a farm, we draw a boundary around it, very simplistic, four inputs, four exports. We take the difference, divide it per acre and per hundredweight. We use it as an indicator for our industry to try to identify what is possible, how do farms compare to each other, and where are the opportunities for improving this. So we worked with a large amount of farms over the last 10 years to collect these balances and try to figure out what is feasible in the state of New York. So we now have indicators for feasible mass balances published in the Journal of Dairy Science in 2014. We have balances per acre on the left here for nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium, and we have balances per hundredweight on the right, and P and K. Farms that farm with their mass balance within these ranges are, in our description, called farms that are managing within the feasible balances. And then we have a set of farms that meet both of those feasible balances. So you can think of those in terms of benchmarks. So farms that meet both of those benchmarks, we call those farms as operating in the optimum operational zone. And since we keep stumbling over that word, we just call it the green box. So when you see the green box here, the farms that are in the green box are farms that are meeting those feasible balances both for per hundredweight basis and per acre basis. Those are the farms that have a lower loss risk for nutrients to the environment, and they also have a higher nutrient use efficiency than farms that are outside of the green box. Okay, keep that green box in mind. If you really want to stumble, use the full word here, but for us, that's our target. That's what we are striving for, and with the dairy industry in New York, we've determined that those are balances that can be achieved. So then it becomes important to look at long-term trends for some of our farms. So we have a sizable database to do that with. This is just a subset of it, four farms that we followed for 8 to 10 years. It shows the changes over time, in this case, nitrogen and phosphorus balances. And it shows us that it's doable. These farms can make changes. Some of them have to go up to get into the green box. Others have to go down to get into the green box. But it's feasible, as demonstrated by these farms and many of the others that we have in our database. The slide on the right is also to point out that we don't have to give up on milk production. We are looking for win-win situations to do this. Improve efficiency at the farm level, reduce the environmental footprint, and keep producing milk, even increasing when it's possible. So these farms are showing that they can make changes. We see that in a larger database when we display this in terms of statewide or watershed balances. We are part of the Chesapeake Bay. Our southern tier is in the upper Susquehanna watershed, the headwaters of the Chesapeake Bay. So we looked at trends for these farms in both the state itself and in the watershed, the upper Susquehanna watershed. And what you see here is arrows that go up. This means that more farms over time are in that green box. The larger numbers of farms that have participated in this study, that have monitored over time, have shown that it is possible to get into that green box even if they were not in the beginning. So we see the declines in the environmental footprint in terms of source reduction. It's very consistent with trends that we see in the partial cropland nitrogen and phosphorus balances in New York, and a decline in the percentage of fields testing excessive for phosphorus in the state of New York. Very consistent trends with very different indicators. So they must be doing something to get into the green box. We wanted to look with those farms and see what they really did to get there. So looking across this large database, the main driver for a change in balance over time was feed imports. Decisions made for feed import. And that means both what you purchase and how much you purchase. But a combination of those two, here again shown by examples of those four longer term case study farms, so feed imports are mostly driving those balances. It's not the exports. It's not the fertilizer. It's the feed imports. In our systems, the fertilizer use was already fairly low for these farms. So feed imports. And that makes you look at farming systems a little closer. So what options do our farming systems have, or do our dairy farms have for options for increasing the percentage of homegrown forage? Big driver for these balances. Percent of homegrown forage. Well, our rotations are primarily alfalfa grass hay fields with corn, silage, and some grain. Typical rotation is 3 to 4 years of alfalfa grass hay and 3 to 4 years of corn silage. In the corn silage years, this is what we have in the fall if you don't do anything else. So we bare soil, and this is where the extending of the growing season in the title comes from. What if we can make use of that time in between corn silage harvest 1 year and corn silage planting the next year, and make use of that and grow something that actually survives our winters and can produce something useful? So the opportunities for improvements are in seeding something right after corn silage harvest, or even when the corn is still growing, but something that can pick up and grow in the fall. In the beginning, there was a big push for cover cropping in our farming systems for all the reasons that we know about: erosion control, nutrient uptake, soil health, everything else. Started working with some farms who thought, well, let's leave it growing when it's an overwintering winter cereal and harvest it, so I can harvest it like a first cutting and get some more forage in the farm. This particular field is a triticale field up in northern New York, for those of us that think that we can't grow this stuff in northern climates. We started experimenting, did some sampling on farms itself. This is one of the earlier databases that showed that in the spring, when it starts warming up, winter cereals like triticale and cereal rye can put on a lot of biomass in a very short period. This particular field put on 0.6 tons of dry matter per week in that very short window in May. So with yields achieving 2 tons or higher, that is of interest to our farmers, both from timing aspects, having a forage in the beginning of this that you can harvest in May, as well as for total yields. We've looked at those total yields over the last many years with on-farm trials, nitrogen rate studies, trying to determine what yields are feasible. It ranges all over the place. We do have fields that are closer to the 0.5 ton of dry matter per acre that we probably don't want to be wasting much time on. But we also have yields that go up to 2.5-3 tons per acre of dry matter, and those are the more important ones. As you can see in these pictures, it's also a crop that's very responsive to nitrogen if the soil is deficient to start with. So it is a crop that needs to be managed, not just an afterthought. We looked at break-even yields. So what do we really need to grow to break even in terms of cost of putting it in and harvesting it? And the ranges are between 0.7 and 2 tons of dry matter per acre. It really depends on whether I needed to purchase nitrogen to grow this material, and it depended on whether or not I impact the yield of the main crop that season. So if I have to take a yield cut for the main season, I need to produce more. Of course, I need to produce more with the winter cereal. But the ranges of 0.7 to 1.7 if I don't need to purchase any nitrogen, which will often be the case in the dairy farms, versus 1 to 2 tons if I needed to purchase nitrogen. How does that compare to what we see in the state of New York? We have a distribution of yields here, and what it's basically showing is that most of our farm fields that we've monitored and that we've looked at are yielding more than 1 ton of dry matter per acre, and still over 50% of our triticale fields that we looked at are producing over 2 tons per acre. It is feasible. our focus needs to be on how to ensure that we have these higher yields and not the lower ones. So it became of interest to look at it. We do have growing season challenges once in a while, so it's not just a matter of putting an extra crop in the season. Some of the years it will not really work when our growing seasons are too short. And brown midrib sorghum Sudan, brown midrib Ford sorghum came in place for us to start looking at as a potential alternative to corn silage. A shorter growing season and potential for high quality forage as well. Our ranges in yields from 4 to over 10 tons. This is dry matter, so multiply by 3 if you want to have a silage equivalent. Definitely comparable to corn silage yields under the right circumstances. We're looking into this a little bit more. What this slide is also showing is that we need nitrogen to manage it. So this is another crop that needs to be managed. If we go back to our picture and zoom in back on the Serra 17 phosphorus focus here, I want to bring it back to what are the potential gains here, and looking at phosphorus removal. If we assume a 2 ton of triticale dry matter yield and a 7 ton of Ford sorghum yield in that type of different rotation, we end up with a crop removal potential of about 100 pounds of P2O5 per acre. We're talking about dairy farms. It keeps cycling internally, but if this means an increased percentage of homegrown forages, it will impact whole farm balances and cause a tighter nutrient cycling for phosphorus on our dairy farms. So to summarize it all together, I'm not sure if coffee is the right comparison here with this group, but we can't continue to pour coffee in a cup that's full. We can't continue to drink out of a cup and that is empty. We got to find out how to better balance, in this case phosphorus, on our farms. So we want to evaluate, set realistic balances, working with the industry, which is what we did for the whole farm balances. We want to give options, we want to focus on adaptive management, people can make changes and are allowed to make changes over time, and have tools in place that can measure and monitor our progress and the farmers' progress over time. For us in New York, those double crop rotations are very promising to look at, and that is what we will continue to work on in our part of the world. And with that, thank you, and we'll open up for questions.
We have plenty of time for questions.
Chef Tang.
Yeah, thanks for that very interesting talk. The thing I just wasn't clear on, so you said that the farms have been approaching more sustainable nutrient levels, right? But is that due to the introduction of the double cropping system, or is that more recent than?
No. So the question is, what has driven the improvements in phosphorus management on the farms in New York over the last decade or even more than that? It's part of our talk tomorrow at 7:17, but it boils down to a combination of increased awareness that we needed to look at phosphorus, a huge effort in on-farm research to try to demonstrate that there are win-win situations. So our fertilizer sales have reduced drastically over the last 10-15 years as a result of farmers and farm advisors seeing with their own eyes in the fields that they didn't need it. We also have at the same time had a big push on precision feeding with our animal science colleagues. So the phosphorus got taken out of the rations, causing a huge improvement in statewide balances over time as well. Yields continue to increase despite the bumps due to the weather, the drought years in between. So it's a combination of a lot of different things. Not so much the double cropping, that has come in only in the last 4 or 5 years. But it shows a potential for us moving forward. And we would like to monitor that over the next several years. Go ahead.
Kind of following up on that, how close to your annual production per acre can you get with the sorghum double crop scenario to the traditional formula? Do you look at that at all?
That's a big question. We only have a small database for that right now. If we assume that we can get the 7 tons of dry matter for forage sorghum combined with the 2 tons in the winter cereal, we end up with 9 tons, right? Multiply that by 3, that is 27 tons of silage equivalent. Our average yields for corn silage in the state of New York are probably closer to 18 to 22 tons. Now, there are exceptions all over the place, so we really need to put some effort in to try to document how well it compares. But the promise is there. It's trying to figure out where the trade-offs are, because we will have to harvest the forage sorghum earlier in the season to allow for seeding of that winter cereal. And we'll have to delay planting until late May, until after the winter cereal comes off. A forage sorghum would fit that picture. What we did see this year is that in a severe drought, forage sorghum is also going to sit there and do nothing until it starts raining again, and then it starts putting on the biomass and really producing. Okay, Tom?
Yes, great presentation. I love this topic. The availability and use of dry distillery greens, does that have much impact on your fossil strategy over the last 20 years?
It's not taken off in New York as it has in some other parts. The phosphorus content is definitely higher. That has been pointed out by our animal nutrition colleagues as well. In the database that we have working with those farms, distillers grain is not a dominant factor at all. But it does show up in some farms. So for the farms that did incorporate it, it's probably a bigger deal than for the majority that is not dealing with it. Yeah?
So I know how hard your team has worked on getting the nutrition right and working with the farmers to get the balances right. And this is really clear where you're getting your reduction. Has there been any change in your population of dairy farmers relative that would have made this easier for you or harder for you? And what I'm thinking of is has there been dairy farmers going out of business?
I'm now looking at Carl, who's sitting right in front of you. We can address that question better.
You want to take a shot at that?
Go ahead.
So I guess one way we tried is, I think, 20% of our producers are making well over 50% of meth in New York. That's been a pretty hard number for 10 years or better. So to the extent that the better manager, large or small, are adopting these practices, the flip side of that is our dairy population. We still have over 5,000 dairies in New York, so there are a lot of dairies, and many small farms are in this database and are showing similar improvement as well.
Right.
So maybe we have a selection bias. A better small farm might be more likely to enter into the study.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So our graduate student Sarah Lyons is working on this. She has a dual interest in nutrition and agronomy, and we're trying to get a better sense of how they manage these crops, both the triticale and the sorghum. Right now, all the responses to using triticale are incredibly positive. Cows like it. Milk production is at least stable or goes up when they start feeding it. So the nutritionists really like the triticale. The picture is not so clear for the forage sorghum. So that one is to be looked at in future years. There's also very few people that are trying out the forage sorghum at this stage. But triticale, winter cereals, if you can harvest it at the right time, it's really high quality feed. And it can fit in the operations as long as you consider it a crop and not something you squeeze in between.
Okay, thank you everyone.